listening to the Kill Radio Weekly News and Review. I'm your announcer, DJ Shy John. Today is Tuesday, February the 12th, 2013. And for those of you involved in a relationship, I would remind you that Thursday is Valentine's Day, February the 14th. At the top of the news today, President Obama is going to address the nation this evening, so be sure you listen to his State of the Union address. Here in Yahoo News, I have Obama's State of the Union, jobs, guns, immigration, climate, gridlock, by Oliver Knox, Yahoo News. Virtually every State of the Union address carries the same presidential message. Now is the time for Americans to set aside partisan politics and do what I want. So what does President Barack Obama want? Can he sell it to skeptical Republicans? Or can he act alone? And where will the sputtering recovery figure as he lays out his priorities? Obama steps up in the packed House of Representatives chamber tonight for a primetime speech that will be his best chance to shape the national agenda at the dawn of his second term. Many of his ambitious goals are already on the table and face considerable Republican opposition. The slaughter of schoolchildren in Newtown, Connecticut, led the president to push a package of proposals to reduce gun violence, while Republican fretting over the party's poor showing in November with Latino voters created an opening to drive immigration reform. And devastating Superstorm Sandy has breathed new life into Obama's campaign to curb global warming. We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations, Obama declared in his inaugural address. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. But the faltering recovery from the Great Recession means that Obama will have to talk about exactly what he talked about 4 years ago, jobs. It's the top issue on voters' minds, well ahead of immigration or climate change or gun violence, and narrowly beating out acting to reduce the deficit. Speaking to Democrats at their issues retreat in Leesburg, Virginia last week, the president sketched out some of his message, promising to build an economy that works for everybody. That means that what you'll hear from me next week, I'm going to be talking about making sure that we're focused on job creation here in the United States of America, he vowed. He also said he would promote access to education and push ahead with a clean energy strategy. As an aside, do you think the Republicans will be fighting those things? GOP officials have been pressing the point that Obama can no longer blame his Republican predecessor, George W. Bush, for the state of the economy. Well, I don't know about that. White House Press Secretary Jay Carney on Monday underlined that Obama inherited an economy in freefall and described job growth as the president's principal preoccupation. By the way, immigration, clean energy, education, all parts of Bush's first, second-term State of the Union, and all eclipsed by his call for the partial privatization of Social Security, which failed. But Republicans, who control the House of Representatives and have enough Senate seats to thwart Obama's agenda there, have thus far given a chilly welcome to his calls to boost infrastructure spending as a way to spur the economy. Like it worked for Roosevelt, I suppose, huh? And along with red state Democrats, they've signaled that they will block Obama's call for an assault weapons ban. Though they may still embrace other responses to gun violence, like enforcing background checks of would-be buyers at gun shows, or boosting funding for mental health. Obama has a potent partner on immigration in Republican Senator Marco Rubio, but immigration reform has seemed on track before, only to derail amid fighting over whether and how to offer the estimated 8 million to 11 million undocumented immigrants a path to citizenship. But Democrats were quick to highlight Republican House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's call on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday for those who came to U.S. soil as children to be given that chance. As for climate change, House Democrats are still smarting from 2010 midterm election losses, partly blamed on the party's embrace of a cap-and-trade plan, while Republicans have shown no appetite for such a grand scheme. The two sides were also at war over damaging, automatic across-the-board spending cuts, known as the sequester. Obama has called for a balanced approach, grouping tax increases on the rich and corporations with spending cuts. Republicans have rejected new tax hikes. The White House, aware of the likelihood of a fresh partisan gridlock, may fall back on steps it can take without congressional approval, much as Obama did throughout the 2012 campaign with his "We Can't Wait" executive actions on jobs. That may prove especially true on climate change. Obama could order new energy conservation steps at federal buildings, press ahead with the Pentagon's campaign to use clean energy, or even, if he's willing to clash with Republicans and coal state Democrats, tighten carbon emission rules on existing power plants. Obama is also expected to push Congress to confirm at least two of his embattled nominees, Republican former Senator Chuck Hagel as Defense Secretary and Richard Cordray to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. As the president is likely to update Americans on the troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, the broader war on terrorism, and the standoff with Iran, at a recent security conference in Munich, Vice President Joe Biden said Obama would be advancing a comprehensive nuclear agenda to strengthen the non-proliferation regime, reduce global stockpiles, and secure nuclear materials. The New York Times suggested Obama could act on this without Congress. What about what he once described as changing the tone in Washington? Obama appears to have learned what Bush did, that promising in effect that my opponents won't criticize me doesn't work. And while members of Congress have made a big show of sitting with members of the other party, it's a bit like the political equivalent of a comb-over. To anyone who knows Washington, it looks odd and it fools no one. Obama made little or no mention in his inaugural address of compromising with Republicans, but since his first post-election press conference, when he declared himself more than familiar with all the literature about presidential overreach in second terms, Obama has bemoaned political partisanship. At the National Prayer Breakfast last week, he said, "I do worry sometimes that as soon as we leave the prayer breakfast, everything we've been talking about the whole time at the prayer breakfast seems to be forgotten on the same day as the prayer breakfast. I mean, you'd like to think that the shelf life wasn't so short," he added. "But I go back to the Oval Office and I start watching the cable news networks and it's like we didn't pray." As he told fellow Democrats in Leesburg, it's important not to read too much into any particular political victory because this country is big, it is diverse, it is contentious, and we don't have a monopoly on wisdom, and we need to remember that. But time is short. Presidents in their second term frequently see their influence on domestic policy drop off sharply after the midterm election or even sooner. Obama made clear in his first post-election press conference that he feels that urgency. "I didn't get reelected just to bask in reelection," he said. "I got elected to do work on behalf of American families and small businesses all across the country who are still recovering from a really bad recession, but are hopeful about the future. The president will try to capitalize on his bully pulpit moment with a Wednesday trip to Asheville, North Carolina, to visit a manufacturer of engine, transmission, and driveline components. He will also travel to Atlanta, Georgia on Thursday, and then home to Chicago on Friday for another event. Next in the news this morning, here's something for all of you thinking about taking a cruise vacation. Reasons to be glad you didn't. This again from Yahoo News. Passengers text about dire conditions on cruise ship by Matt Gutman and Alyssa Newcomb. Good morning, America. Passengers on the fire-damaged Carnival cruise ship stranded in the Gulf of Mexico have reported worsening conditions, including scarce running water, no air conditioning, and long lines for food. Carnival said original plans to haul the crippled ship to Progreso, Mexico, have been scrapped because the ship has drifted about 90 miles north because of strong currents. Instead, the Triumph will be towed to Mobile, Alabama, and should arrive Thursday. For the more than 4,200 people on board, Thursday could not come soon enough. Conditions are getting worse by the hour, passenger Deborah Reitmeier told ABC News in a text message. Cabin carpets are wet with urine and water. Toilets are overflowing inside cabins. We are having to sleep in the hallways. Onion and cucumber sandwich last night, she added. Passenger Shelley Crosby told ABC News in a text message that many people are sleeping in tents set up on the ship's deck. Passengers had limited access to bathrooms, food, and hot coffee Monday. With lack of power, there's no refrigeration, so the stink on board is apparently intense, which is one of the reasons many people are choosing to sleep on the deck. We stood in line for 4 hours to get a hamburger, Crosby texted. Cell phone reception is just as scarce, coming only when another Carnival ship pulls alongside to drop off supplies. Carnival acknowledges the problems, but said there's plenty of food and water aboard and that it is working on the sanitation issue. All of our guests are safe, and we're doing everything we can to make them as comfortable as possible, Gary Cahill, president and CEO of Carnival Cruise Line, said in a statement Monday night. A tugboat reached the Carnival Triumph, cruise ship bobbing and listing in the Gulf of Mexico Monday night. The tug has tied up with the Carnival Triumph, but will wait until today for the expected arrival of a second tug before towing the cruise ship to port. The ship, which is 2.5 football fields long and bigger than the Titanic, will then be towed back to shore at the rate of a few miles per hour. The Carnival Triumph is now little more than a 100,000-ton cork bobbing in the Gulf of Mexico without propulsion since the fire broke out Sunday morning. No one was hurt in the fire, but the ship lost power and is relying on a backup generator. Brett Nutt said that his wife, Bethany, who was on board, called him to say the plumbing wasn't working on the ship. She said there's no running water. They just really got food there to them tonight, and there's no power whatsoever, other than the emergency flasher lights that are on, he said Monday. She was crying and hysterical. At one point Sunday, passengers were reportedly using buckets to relieve themselves. Sunday's fire was extinguished by an automated system, but not before it hobbled the ship, according to the Coast Guard. The Carnival Triumph departed Galveston Thursday with 3,143 guests and 1,086 crew on board for a Mexican cruise, which was due to return to the port Monday. And now, ladies and gentlemen, at long last, I bring you the Harper's Weekly Review for February 12th, 2013. NBC News disclosed the existence of a classified Justice Department memo authorizing the use of drone strikes to kill American citizens. The 16-page white paper argues that the president does not need to have clear evidence of an imminent attack on American citizens or interests in order to legally approve a strike, and that the targets of such strikes do not need to have been charged with a crime. The threat posed by Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, states the memo, demands a broader concept of imminence. At a confirmation hearing, the Senate Intelligence Committee questioned prospective CIA Director John O. Brennan about the drone program. "What we need to do is optimize transparency," said Brennan, "but at the same time, optimize secrecy." Committee members noted that Brennan appeared nervous as he faced questions about torture. "You're on your fourth glass of water," said Richard Burr, Republican, North Carolina. "I don't want to be accused of waterboarding you." A human rights NGO reported that 54 countries helped facilitate the CIA's secret detention, rendition, and interrogation program, and U.S. military officials staged an exercise to prepare for a hypothetical mass migration to Guantanamo Bay. Authorities in Los Angeles considered using drones to locate Christopher Dorner, an ex-policeman wanted for killing two relatives of a former LAPD captain and shooting three officers. "I will bring unconventional and asymmetrical warfare to those in LAPD uniform," wrote Dorner in a manifesto in which he accused the department of racism and excessive use of force. Police shot an elderly woman in a blue Toyota Tacoma they took to belong to Dorner, who drives a gray Nissan Titan. "To the credit of the officers involved," said the victim's attorney, "after the shooting, they acted professionally." Former officers revealed that London's Metropolitan Police Service had stolen the identities of dead children to use as aliases in undercover operations. A policeman in Upper Gwynedd, Pennsylvania, shot himself in the foot. Doctors informed the family of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez that they didn't expect him to recover from cancer, and Pope Benedict XVI announced that he was abdicating as of February 28th for health reasons. His resignation, said Cardinal Timothy Dolan, is but another sign of his great care for the church. Scientists unveiled the reconstructed face of Richard III after confirming that skeletal remains discovered beneath a parking lot in Leicester, England, belonged to the dead king. "He's very handsome," said a member of the Richard III Society. "It doesn't look like the face of a tyrant." A hacker broke into email accounts belonging to the family of George W. Bush and released images of paintings by Bush that depict him bathing. "Nothing untoward is shown," wrote one art critic. "He is chaste and untouched, even when alone." The U.S. military began moving equipment out of Afghanistan and transferred command of U.S. and NATO forces there for the final time before a planned withdrawal in 2014. "Victory here," said outgoing Commander John Allen, "will never be marked by a parade." The United Nations reported that bribes paid to Afghan public officials in 2012 amounted to twice the country's domestic revenue for services. Syrians rioted over tent donations at a refugee camp in Jordan, and soldiers loyal to President Bashar al-Assad danced in an online video to Usher's "Yeah." An Egyptian court ordered the government to block access to YouTube for a month because the site was hosting the anti-Islam film trailer Innocence of Muslims, Barack Obama announced plans for his first presidential visit to Israel, and Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad declared his intention to visit the Gaza Strip and outer space. The leader of the team that built the World Trade Center died, and the Pakistan government announced that it was constructing a $30 million amusement park in Abbottabad, the city where Osama bin Laden was assassinated. The British House of Commons voted to legalize same-sex marriage, and the Boy Scouts of America delayed until May a decision on whether to lift its ban on gay members. Floyd Corkins, who pleaded guilty to charges related to an August shooting attack on the headquarters of the Anti-Gay Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., reportedly told investigators he had planned to smear chicken sandwiches on the faces of dying staff members. "They endorse Chick-fil-A," said Corkins, "so I was going to use that as a statement." A transgendered woman was arrested in Florida for illegally injecting silicone into men's buttocks. CBS advised Grammy Awards attendees not to wear revealing clothing. "Please be sure the genital region is adequately covered," wrote the station, "so that there is no visible, puffy, bare skin." The world's most prolific streaker announced his retirement. And a San Francisco man was acquitted of public indecency charges related to an attempt at urban nudism when he explained that what appeared to a witness to have been masturbation was in fact an attempt to hide scars on his stomach, and what appeared to have been lubricant was in fact eczema cream. "Mr. Sierra's failed attempt at being a nudist," said the man's lawyer, "does not warrant lifetime registration as a sex offender." Nobody deserves that. An African-American couple named Jason and Anelia Black sued Disneyland for discrimination after the white rabbit refused to touch their children. Laysan albatross Wisdom, the world's oldest bird, hatched a chick, and a former LAPD detective revealed that a cadaver dog named Buster may have solved the 1947 Black Dahlia murder of Elizabeth Short. "We have established as fact that the basement," he said, "still smells of death." This article written by Jacob Z. Gross. Well, we've reached another week of exciting news. Everyone, please be kind to each other in the coming week, and please stay the heck out of the news.